The world is moving toward renewable energy, but will it be just for everyone? Tune in to Eyes on a Just Energy Transition every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 10 a.m. East African Standard Time, where we explore how Africa can embrace clean energy without leaving communities behind. Because justice must fuel the transition. The energy future is here, but who benefits?
In a world racing toward clean energy, who's left behind? Welcome to Eyes on a Just Energy Transition, the program that highlights on Africa's journey toward a fair and inclusive energy future.
Hello, our dear listener. Welcome to Witness Radio, your trusted voice. You are listening to Eyes on a Just Energy Transition, where we take you on an informative journey of energy transition across Africa. And this is Witness Radio series program, The Media in Renewable Energy. In this series, we are using the power of the media to shine a light on Uganda's journey towards clean, sustainable energy. To listen to us, visit our website www.witnessradio.org or visit Google Play Store and download the Witness Radio app. And in case you'd like to reach us out, please chat with us on WhatsApp +256 745 965 765 or by calling us directly on +256 414 697 221 and we'll hear from you, or on all our social media platforms. Now, as you may know, Uganda is among the African countries that are currently on the transition journey, transiting from burning of fossil fuels like coal, oil, gas, and firewood to renewable or clean energy. And the transition is expected to deliver enormous socio-economic benefits to these countries, including improving energy access, creating jobs, and boosting energy security. And to achieve these benefits, these countries must make a great turn away from burning of the fossil fuels and firewood. And in this program, we bring you different renewable energy experts, partners, beneficiaries, and individuals to enlighten us as they share with us their experiences about the transition journey to renewable energy or clean energy. By 2023, Uganda had issued over 33 million carbon credits under both compliance and voluntary markets, according to the country's report to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. At the same time, nearly $942 million has been mobilized for 38 climate projects, most coming from international partners. These numbers make Uganda one of the most active carbon market participants on the African continent. But what does this mean for everyday Ugandans? Beyond storing hundreds of thousands of tons of carbon dioxide, these projects are said to be channeling much-needed cash into rural communities that farmers are earning income from trees, protecting the environment, and building a green future all at once. But we also hear that such projects are causing dispossession and violence. In today's Eyes on a Just Energy Transition, we travel to the farms where these green economies are taking root. We speak to farmers participating in these projects, companies doing carbon business, as well as carbon voluntary carbon expert to explore whether these promises of climate finance are really paying off on the ground. Stay with us.
Kwaliko abapoliisi, abapoliisi babiri, abakulembeddemu Kajula nga y'abakulembeddemu ne Peter.
In 2004, Kajura and Peter, who are all workers of Kikonda Plantation, arrested me with support of the police. They said I was encroaching on company land. By the time of the arrest, they found me on land, brutally arrested me. And I spent 3 days in detention with my two children and only gave us food once. Imagine, for the 3 days, we ate once.
The experience you have just heard is of 63-year-old Nalugu Rosemary, a resident in Kachbamango village in Chankwanzi district. She is one of the 10,000 of residents who were displaced by the huge Chikonda reforestation project. During the evictions, her and the rest of the 30 villages originally located on the land lost their property worth billions. Houses and crops were being destroyed, while residents suffered threats and physical violence, including sexual harassment of women. For Nalugo, her dream of living a good life was shattered.
When I was released from police, I went to my garden, but everything had been destroyed. I sat and cried because the money I used for farming was a loan from the bank. Now that my crops had been destroyed, I didn't have money to pay the loan. The bank instead took my plot of land, which had my house. I was instead left with nothing, and now I live at church.
We are going for a short break. When we return, we'll take a closer look at how Nalugo and others came to occupy the land in question.
You're listening to Eyes on a Just Energy Transition.
Eyes on a Just Energy Transition, a program that unpacks Africa's shift toward cleaner, fairer, and more sustainable energy. Join us every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 10 a.m. East African Standard Time as we spotlight communities, policies, and voices shaping the continent's energy future. Stay informed, stay empowered. Keep your eyes on a just energy transition. Right here on Witness Radio.
Every day, every hour, tune in to Witness Radio, your number one choice. Witness Radio is the voice of the people. Listen to the power.
Welcome back from the break, and thank you for tuning to Witness Radio. In today's special reportage, we're exploring Uganda's reforestation carbon projects, looking closely at their impacts on communities and the environment. Now, how did the over 10,000 residents occupy the said land?
The land, which the Chikonda Reserve occupies now, is public land according to the government of Uganda, and therefore the government's to lease out. But how did Nalugo and others enter the forest land in the first place? According to interviews conducted by Witness Radio, some residents claimed they had already been living on the land as early as the 1980s. Others, like Nalugo, said they were invited by local leaders in the 1990s to settle and utilize what was then considered free and bushy land.
I occupied
my land, which measured 3 acres, in the early 2000s. They called us and said whoever wanted to farm in the land, they should come and cultivate it so that they could be well in future. I remember the leader was an LC3 chairperson who called Muchibi. He called us, and when I heard about it, I personally joined other people to enter the forest.
But later, around 2002, the government changed its mind and decided to take over the land to implement a big reforestation project, destroying crops, homes, and people's livelihoods in the process. Officially, an area of over 12,000 hectares state-owned land in now the Changwanzi district was earmarked for reforestation as early as the 1960s and declared a national forest. However, it was not until 2002, after international interests and pressure for reforestation as a countermeasure to combat climate change were increasing, that action was taken and the evictions started. At that time, the area hosted both cattle keepers and farmers who lived and worked together. Claiming to have been residing on the land for a long time before the Chikonda project arrived, many of the former residents count as legal occupants, according to Ugandan law. As such, they are entitled to the land, or at least to reasonable compensation. However, these rights were not granted to them. Instead, people were violently evicted and left with no land or homes. Nalugo remembers.
I was cultivating in the forest, planting maize and beans. But in 2003, during the evictions, all my crops were harvested and taken by the company workers on their tractors. As I kept looking at them, I was left stranded as they left me with nothing.
The Ugandan government commissioned the German company Global Woods International AG to establish the Chikonda Natural Reserve, a monocultural tree plantation with eucalyptus and pine trees on the land. In addition, 20% of the area was dedicated as a natural reserve, with strict rules to protect native plant and animal species. Global Woods is specialized in selling carbon offset credits and committed to manage the area starting in 2002 with a 49-year tree farming lease. In 2020, the company sold its project to the Ugandan company Nile Firewood Limited, which is now running the wood plantation, while Global Woods continued to assist as an intermediary in the trading of carbon credits until 2022. Long-term Chikonda plantation employee Mr. Alex Jambona explains that carbon projects not only have to prove that they reduce carbon dioxide, but also have to show that they are in general acting responsible in protecting towards the environment.
Keeping the wetlands, yes, and also if there are those natural forests within your land, you also keep them. Which have they maybe the canopy close about 6 to 7, the canopy close, you also are respecting them, then you plant other areas which are they are open.
Carbon projects have to follow so-called carbon credit verification standards that define environmental but also social requirements that need to be fulfilled.
If you are a big forest company or you are a big forestry planter, you need to think about the social aspect. The social aspect, I mean working with communities around or around your forest, working with school, working with the local administration, for example, sub-county, district people, local stakeholder engagement, showing that you are working with them, you work with them, then they will respect your business, you are respecting them, like that.
According to Mr. Jambona's explanation, the company seems to be aware of the importance of good relationships with its neighbors. The Chikonda project also claims in several public statements that they were not involved in the forceful evictions. However, working together with the neighboring communities did not only present a problem in the beginning. Mr. Kabangira George is the chairperson of the committee representing the Chikonda project affected persons. We met him and other victims of the Chikonda evictions in Kachwamango village in Zambia sub-county, Jangwanzi district in central Uganda. He maps out the ongoing impacts the project has on his community, even though the evictions ended 23 years ago.
Ever since the company came in, the situation worsened. They don't allow us to access the water dams in the forest. There are also army and the other security agencies guarding the plantation. When the army comes, they tell us they belong to the NFA and that they are also keeping the company plantations. Also, you find that the police is taking part. They come and take our animals and demand money. We have no other dams nearby. That's where we take our animals for grazing and drinking water, because we are a cattle-keeping community.
When evicted, some former residents bought land nearby the reserve, while others scattered. But the neighbors, who are both farmers and animal keepers, say violence by company workers is unabated and is at times supported by the security officials.
Our animals
have died. Some are beaten while others are seized, kept in farm while hungry. They don't release them before giving them cash. They demand around 20,000
to 50,000
per head. You find that if cows are taken and people don't have money to pay for their release, you then need to take a loan and get money, then pay to remove them. This is now another revenue for them.
Besides the violations and abuses, also environmental hazards are increasing. George, says.
Another challenge is the heavy winds that disturb us. They have killed our animals, and in the recent event, the strong winds blew down our crops and trees. When the trees fell, they killed one of the community members' cattle. Four died immediately, and others had to be slaughtered because they were already weakened with broken bones. Even the neighboring community, a person died when a tree fell on him as he was walking home.
Falling trees caused by heavy winds are much more likely in commercial monoculture plantations than they are in natural forests. Monocultures consist mainly of one tree species. All trees are usually the same age and are cut at the same time, leaving the soil exposed to weather conditions and provide openings for winds to rush through. Mixed natural forests, on the other hand, are generally more resistant to changing environmental conditions than monocultures. The more diverse the trees are in terms of crown and root shape and soil and climate requirements, the more resilient the forest is to environmental changes, like increasing winds. And as we hear from Mr. Chabona again, even when it comes to carbon reduction, local tree species are more advantageous.
The best trees, of course, it is the broader living trees. They have more like mahogany, musizi, eucalyptus, like that. Because when you have natural forests like budongo, mavira, and the others, they have a high concentration of carbon because they are broadleaf trees in the forest. But for commercial purposes, because my absorption will take a long time, many mahogany will take a lot of time for it to mature. Mm. But as a business person, you need some income in between or not long time. At least you can plant eucalyptus, you can plant pine like that, because those are the two tree species which are commercial for business persons.
Even though native and slow-growing trees are officially considered more suitable for carbon reduction, the reserve mainly plants eucalyptus and pine trees in monocultures because of their economic advantages. All of that officially in the name of reforestation and climate protection. But what actually are those carbon credits that cause so many problems for the communities around the Chikonda plantation, and what do they have to do with environmental protection? To explain the idea behind carbon trading, we need to take a step back and first look at the problem of global warming, which is considered the main cause of the climate crisis. Planet Earth is surrounded by a layer of gases such as carbon dioxide, known as the atmosphere. This protective layer makes life on Earth possible, as it ensures that the temperature remains relatively constant by trapping the sun's rays between itself and the Earth. This system has worked well and in perfect balance for millions of years. However, in mid-19th century, human activities began to affect the climate for the first time. The global human population has never been as large as it is today and continues to grow rapidly. This is accompanied by what we call industrial progress. More and more is being produced worldwide. We burn fossil fuels and travel in cars, ships, or airplanes that burn fuel. All these things produce so-called greenhouse emissions, such as carbon dioxide, which thicken the layer of gas around the planet. Now, increasingly more heat is stored, which leads to the planet heating up in an unnatural and dangerous way. The majority of emissions are produced in countries of the global north, which are more developed and have many industries. However, the consequences of global warming have a global impact and particularly affect societies based in the global south. Now, widely recognizing the dangers of global warming, the nations of the world have agreed to work together to reduce global carbon dioxide emissions. Many countries have agreed to limit their annual emissions and invest in technologies that produce little to no emissions. Companies are only allowed to produce a limited and decreasing amount of emissions annually and are fined if they cannot meet their goals to reduce their carbon dioxide output. One of many concepts developed for this purpose is voluntary carbon trading. This idea was included in the Paris Agreement, an international treaty adopted in 2015 to combat climate change by limiting global warming to well below 2 degrees, preferably to 1.5 degrees compared to pre-industrial levels. Article 6 of that agreement offers the groundwork for carbon markets, following the aim to include private sector actors into the task of emission reduction. This way, reducing emissions became a business model. Private actors and companies can now develop ideas and projects of how to reduce emissions, and the carbon market offers financing to accomplish these initiatives. The idea is to realize projects that either prevent or even reduce emissions. To prevent emissions, this could, for example, mean to introduce renewable energy sources instead of energy sources based on fossil fuels, or to improve the energy sufficiency of production processes. Projects that try to reduce emissions include, beneath others, the renaturation of moors in wetlands and the planting of trees that store carbon dioxide. The Chikonda Natural Reserve is one example for a carbon offset project that uses reforestation to bind carbon. The company plants trees, which, like all plants, do photosynthesis. By growing, the trees filter carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and split it into oxygen and water, which are not harmful to the atmosphere. To finance carbon offset endeavors, implementing companies can issue and sell carbon certificates. One for every ton of carbon dioxide that is transformed by the trees. Meaning that a carbon certificate is like a receipt certifying that one ton of carbon dioxide has been removed from the atmosphere. These certificates are traded on the global voluntary carbon market, where companies, organizations, and even private people worldwide can buy them to contribute to emission reduction. By doing so, big companies and countries in the global north that cause a lot of emissions can show their good intention to reduce the pollution they are causing and improve their image and carbon footprint.
Witness Radio.
Witness Radio.
Witness Radio.
Witness Radio.
Breaking the silence and elevating community voices.
Witness Radio, thank you so much. You have become our voices. Nobody would know what is taking place because for a long time we had not known what was going on in Kiriandongo, what had taken place in Mubende, because the grabbers operate at night when people are asleep. But you have done a lot.
Witness Radio.
Witness Radio.
Witness Radio.
Witness Radio.
You're listening to Eyes on a Just Energy Transition.
According to the TSVCM, the Task Force on Scaling Voluntary Carbon Market, a private sector-led initiative working to scale an effective and efficient voluntary carbon market to help meet the goals of the Paris Agreement, voluntary carbon projects are not only supposed to offset carbon, but should bring general benefit for the countries, regions, and communities they are located in. After assessing the potentials of the private carbon market, TSVCM sounds quite positive in their final report in January 2021.
Quoting TSVCM final report, page 1. In addition to climate mitigation, many projects can also generate broader environmental, social, and economic benefits, ranging from increased biodiversity, job creation, support for local communities, and health benefits from avoided pollution. Furthermore, as a significant share of potential projects are located in the global south, carbon credits can generate flows of private capital to these economies.
What we have heard earlier from the community members affected by the Chikonda reforestation project, however, paints a different picture. This local community is suffering because of the tree planting project being realized in their neighborhood and former homes. Could this be a misguided, isolated case? Or are we observing a reoccurring pattern? our search for further Ugandan forestry projects aimed at carbon offset takes us to Mubende district. We are meeting land and environmental rights defender Julius Ndagise and other members of communities surrounding the huge Namwaza Central Forest Reserve.
Abantu benchikira bakosibwa project ya New Forest Company, Uganda. Company yakosa families wenda mwemu.
My community was affected by the New Forest Company project. The project affected 901 families, accounting for over 10,000 people in 7 villages of Mubende district. In order to pave way for the project, their property, including crops, were destroyed, houses were burnt, animals were killed, and burial sites were destroyed. And we also recorded 2 cases of fatality where children drowned as they were running to escape the brutal violence. Many soldiers had been deployed to enforce the eviction, and this created panic in the area.
What Julius Ndagise describes bears a frightening resemblance to what those affected by the Chikonda project report. Since 2004, the British New Forest Company has been operating the Namwaza Central Forest Reserve reforestation initiative by planting trees, harvesting timber, and issuing carbon certificates. Here too, it is a governmental forest reserve that is managed by a foreign company on behalf of the government and at the cost of the former residents. Unfortunately, the Witness Radio team was not able to speak directly to representatives of the company to ask them about their perspective. However, on their website, the New Forest Company offers a long list of social impacts and benefits it allegedly provides for the residents of the villages surrounding the plantation. There it says,
"Quoting NFC website, the New Forest Company is very proud of our impact to date and excited about how that will continue to grow and improve in the future."
The company offers a long list of social impacts, alleging they have
created 1,331 jobs, the majority of which are lower, committed to paying above the market wages for unskilled labor, invested over $9 million in our strategic community development program impacting over 465,000 people, distributed 6.5 million tree seedlings to 5,000 neighboring farmers, and they built 3 high schools and 30 double classroom blocks and dormitories, built 31 clean water points, and they also build 9 healthy centers or doctor's accommodation.
Witness Radio asked those affected about the benefits promised. But Ndagise underlines that the promoted activities are more about the company's image than about real support for the local community.
Projects such as these ones are not real development. They just cause total suffering, abject poverty, and backwardness to people. Because their only benefit is to the government, who gets tax, and also the company itself, because it gets profits on grabbed land. They have not even given jobs to us, the evictees, or the people neighboring the plantation.
Jane, another former resident whose name was changed here due to fear of retaliation, revealed that the assured impacts are not seen in the communities surrounding the plantation or by those who suffered evictions. Regarding employment, she adds,
"We sometimes request jobs from them, but they don't give them to us. They just hire people from far communities."
During the expulsion, the communal institutions that existed in the area, such as schools, were destroyed. Although the company later built new schools, as promised, these are not accessible to the residents who were most affected. Mr. Tumvezije Bernhardt, another affected resident, explains.
They built schools, for instance, in Karuana, but a poor man like me, Can't take my children to that school. It's expensive and far away from where most of us relocated.
And it is not only crucial educational or medical infrastructure that was lost.
Ebitundu bye batugobamu twazika ya abantu baffe nika tetukirizibwa kugenda yo.
We buried our beloved ones in our former land, where the New Forest Company planted its trees. Our burial sites are still in the farms. But we can't relocate them, visit or clean them up. Some were destroyed by the company during the evictions, while others are still existing.
In African cultural contexts, burial sites are regarded sacred spaces. Damaging or desecrating these graves is viewed as both culturally unacceptable and potentially harmful due to associated spiritual beliefs. In case of the Namwaza community, these sacred graves were destroyed and families were not given the opportunity to exhume or relocate their loved ones. Despite what remains of the burial sites, community members are still not allowed to visit them. Jane explains.
We are not allowed to pass through the forest. We cannot go and collect firewood. When you go there, you risk being raped if you're a woman or young girl. People are beaten and injured. They don't allow people to go there, and company workers are continuing to commit violence to people neighboring the forest plantation. They eat their food and steal their goats.
Are there international frameworks in place to protect people like them? We are going to a short break, and when we return, we'll explore whether such frameworks exist and whether they were actually followed.
Eyes on a Just Energy Transition, a program that unpacks Africa's shift toward cleaner, fairer, and more sustainable energy. Join us every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 10 a.m. East African Standard Time as we spotlight communities, policies, and voices shaping the continent's energy future. Stay informed, stay empowered. Keep your eyes on a Just Energy Transition. Right here on Witness Radio.
You're listening to Eyes on a Just Energy Transition.
Every day, every hour, tune in to Witness Radio, your number one choice. Witness Radio is the voice of the people. Listen to the power.
Welcome back to Witness Radio. As promised, we continue our program. We are examining the international protections meant for communities like Nalgos. Were these guidelines followed? And if not, what does it mean for the people on the ground?
International human rights frameworks, especially the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, provide clear protection for all people. Article 17 states that everyone has a right to own property and must not be arbitrarily deprived of it. Article 5 adds that no one should be subjected to cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment. Principles such as these mean that whenever a project is planned, whether for development, conservation, or commercial purposes, it must be designed and implemented in a way that respects people's dignity, protects their land rights, and involves them meaningfully in decisions that affect their lives. Even if we put the harmful social and cultural consequences aside, the Namwaza communities claim they are witnessing a sequence of harmful environmental impacts of this carbon plantation project that officially aims for climate protection. According to Jane,
this project claims to protect the environment, but in just a short period of time, the trees are cut and land is left bare. Now part of the land is used for coffee growing, while another piece is used for goat farming. Also, the weather is rapidly changing because of these trees. There's a lot of sunshine.
Against what TSVCM predicted and the New Forest Company promised, people affected by the big governmental reforestation initiative end up in a social and economic situation worse than before the project. the company's investments in the social structure of the area do not compensate for the damage caused. Monoculture timber production, if anything, limits biodiversity in the area, and the profits from selling carbon credits do not reach local communities but stay with the British company and therefore in the global north. Although the large number of trees planted stores carbon dioxide in line with the idea of the carbon market entered in the Paris Agreement, it also increases the global wealth imbalance. It seems fair to say that these two large-scale reforestation projects in Ugandan national forests cannot be considered successful carbon projects. However, the basic idea behind carbon trading, reducing global emissions, seems sensible, particularly if formats can be found in which the profits from these projects actually remain in the global south, with the countries and communities most affected by global warming. Hoping for better news, reporters from Witness Radio set out to find projects that do things differently and work with communities instead of driving them away. In Chigaga village, Kabale sub-county in Hoima district in midwestern Uganda, they met some local farmers that are participating in the Trees for Global Benefit program, a carbon offsetting scheme by the Environmental Conservation Trust of Uganda, in short, EcoTrust. Mr. Jorum Bashima, a well-known community educator, local farmer and spokesperson in the area, explains the initial situation.
As you look at the land terrain, here it used to be forest, the forest cover that was almost covering all the riverine down here. When you see there, that is Pugoma Central Forest Reserve, and down here is Wambaga Central Forest Reserve. So here is a corridor called Kanyaburu Riverine, Kanyaburu Riverine Forest Riverine, that connects the two Central Forest Reserves, and it was totally covered by trees. And uphill this way also, and the other side, used to be big savanna trees and savanna bush. But because of big populations on the ground, all the trees and bushes were cleared, and even the forests down there were also cut completely to zero. Some NGOs came in, inclusive of EcoTrust, encouraging people to grow trees for both regeneration of the environment and also income. They came in the name of income. Now when people heard of income, actually they were very excited and they were very happy to receive the project. At large, we have over 2,000 farmers in the districts of Chikuba and Hoima.
EcoTrust is a not-for-profit conservation organization established in Uganda in 1999 to conserve biological diversity and enhance social welfare by promoting innovative and sustainable environmental management. In that capacity, it receives and manages private as well as public funding. In 2003, the organization launched their leading Trees for Global Benefit program, a carbon offsetting scheme that has been implemented in the Hoima and Chikuba district since 2013. The program encourages small-scale farmers to plant trees that are native to the region on part of their land instead of growing food, as they did before, characterizing that as long-term investment. Before its implementation, people were told they would benefit from the project and that it would bring financial stability through long-term investments. Mr. Rukundo Harrington Herbert of Butimba East Village, Budoma Parish, was a budging farmer and businessman who claims was coerced into the project.
Project
I used my money to buy seedlings, and I have been in this project for over 18 years. They told me when I plant trees, I will become very rich. I have a family of 7 people, and before the project, I had planted my land with bananas on 4 acres, and I would sell them and send the children to school. Every week, I would get 300,000 shillings to 400,000 shillings. But when I heard that trees would pay me more money than the bananas, then I had to cut the bananas to plant trees.
Before the project, he was earning enough to take care of his family. He had 5 acres of land and planted 4 acres with trees. But the project has not benefited him as he expected, and he is now struggling to provide for his family.
I was paid 3 times, 440,000 shillings, 280,000 shillings, and now 150,000 shillings. The company only told us to plant trees, that we shall get good money, and now this is the money I have been paid for the 18 years. I don't know if this is what they meant as big money. They have not been transparent in all this process.
Rukundo says he has decided to breach his contract with the company that obliges him to grow the trees for a period of 20 years. He's cutting them to plant food instead.
When I saw that the money was very little, I cut 2 acres of the 4 acres of trees to plant bananas again because they were yielding well initially.
Spokesperson Mr. Bashima summarizes the community's experiences.
You sign a contract of growing trees and harvest them after 20 years. That is the agreement. And the money, as I told you, is not stipulated properly to community people's understanding. And to the other question, if a farmer decides to cut the trees before the end of the period, some farmers have been threatened, but no serious action has taken place, has been imposed on them. Nobody has been jailed yet, but people have been threatened. And people are encouraged to keep the agreement. However, people don't see it of a meaning to keep hungry with the trees. Some prefer to cut the trees down and go back to what they used to do on their land.
One of the main problems with the project is that Ecotrust did not provide participants with sufficient information in advance. Rather, they were told they would get rich if they participated in the project.
We don't know who buys carbon. The community doesn't know who buys carbon. They even don't know how much carbon they produce. And to myself alone, I think this is maybe the role of the government and Ecotrust. They could be the ones, maybe, who are selling. But for us, we don't sell. We are only given money to do management. We are not aware if government is selling or Ecotrust is selling. But we see people coming to measure the trees. And we hear, even from other interventions, in other meetings and trainings, this should not be, this is actually not our project. We are only given money to do management, to manage the trees at the younger stage. But for us, we don't sell carbon. And we don't, we even don't know. We don't know any other thing. We don't know who buys, why he buys, where the market is. None of the community member knows.
So who profits from carbon sales? And why didn't the organization inform participating smallholders about how much carbon they neutralize or how carbon trading works in the first place? In an extensive report titling Finance for Integrated Landscape Management, De-risking Smallholder Farmer Investments in Integrated Landscape Management, EcoTrust explains its specifically developed financial mechanism with 12 key principles for the successful implementation of the project. Principle 8 states,
EcoTrust report. The earnings from carbon, along with the long-term carbon agreements, provide incentives and collateral for the participating household to develop multiple income streams.
The report lists numerous services, including economic counseling, educational programs, and financial support, and underlines that its aim is to create economic motivation for climate action.
Quoting EcoTrust report, the Trees for Global Benefit mechanism provide incentives through payment of environment services, a model that enables thousands of households to engage in forest landscape restoration as a business. TGB uses blended finance to support the various activities under its primary, secondary, and tertiary investment phases. The blended finance includes EcoTrust's own revenue, community contributions, public investment, private sector, foreign direct investment. TGB uses this four-layered financing model to drive and support the various phases of the program to ensure that $6 of every $10 is delivered to the financial beneficiary, and that's the local smallholder farmer.
The outline structure of EcoTrust's carbon offset project appears promising. According to the report, participants should not only benefit financially from the project, but are indeed the intended main beneficiaries of the carbon sale profits. However, in practice, farmers who have been involved in the project for over 15 years say,
nobody has ever been paid for carbon in these two districts. I'm very sure. With that, I'm very sure.
Contrary to the promised benefits, the participating farmers we have heard from complain about loss of income and increasing economic uncertainty, which has forced many of them to cut down trees and plant faster yielding crops. This shows concerning contradictions between the project's goals published in the report and the farmers' experiences. Neither the EcoTrust website nor the before quoted report offer specific information about how the project addresses grievances during implementation, how carbon dioxide reduction is calculated, and how this translates into economic benefits for the smallholder farmers participating in the project. We intended to discuss these questions and concerns with EcoTrust's communications personnel, Mr. Jonah Butsatsa, but he did not respond positively to Witness Radio's requests, both calls and emails. But at least the projects help the environment, don't they? As it turns out, even that is a complicated question. The Belgian NGO Carbon Market Watch deals with this and other questions relating to carbon trading. Witness Radio spoke to Mr. Jonathan Crook, who is one of the organization's experts on the topic of the voluntary carbon market.
Carbon credit is meant to represent a ton of CO2 that has been avoided or reduced or even removed from the atmosphere. But in many cases, a carbon credit can't reliably guarantee that outcome. Many peer-reviewed scientific articles, as well as findings from NGOs, journalists, and carbon credit rating agencies, have actually found significant quality problems across a range of carbon credits, which undermine trust that they can actually deliver what's being claimed.
As a global market, carbon trading is very complex and therefore susceptible to fraud, not least because of opaque control and certification mechanisms. In recent years, there have been repeated cases in which the impact of carbon offset projects has been significantly exaggerated or even simply invented. Another problem identified by the expert is that carbon trading is seen by large companies in the global north as a means of buying their way out of environmental responsibility.
And so the problem is that in many cases, carbon credits are being used by companies and increasingly by countries to claim that they're net zero or carbon neutral. The use of carbon credits has real-world consequences in terms of potentially delaying internal climate action for some of the world's heaviest polluters who need to massively reduce their own emissions first and foremost. And relying on carbon credits can become a way out, since it's much easier and cheaper to buy carbon credits than to substantively change business practices. So Shell, for example, is currently the main buyer of carbon credits on the voluntary carbon market, and the second biggest buyer to date. And Delta is the largest buyer of carbon credits historically, though they've now stepped away from the market in recent years. But it's striking that these two companies, who are responsible for massively fueling the climate crisis, are the largest historic and ongoing buyers of carbon credits, which they've used to greenwash their products and services as having a minimal climate impact. And those are just two examples of a systemic problem in the way that carbon credits are used irresponsibly by companies.
Nevertheless, the expert sees potential in the basic idea of carbon trading.
That said, a carbon credit doesn't need to be used for greenwashing purposes to supposedly offset greenhouse gas emissions. Because in and of itself, a carbon credit is just a certificate, and there's no obligation for the buyer to say that it erases the climate impact of their ongoing pollution. Rather than say that they or their products or services are net zero or carbon neutral, a company might still purchase carbon credits, but more responsibly communicate about what this actually means, so that they're supporting mitigation somewhere else, but that it in no way compensates for their own damaging climate impact. This is an example of a contribution claim, as it's called, which is opposed to a compensation claim for offsetting purposes. And contribution claims are gaining traction in the market. And that's a much more transparent and honest way to use carbon credits. It might sound like semantics, but it's critical that companies don't actually mislead regulators and the public about their true climate impact, which carbon credits cannot fix. So the point is that carbon credits themselves are not always the problem, but rather how they're used by companies really is very problematic in many cases. Because some carbon credit projects do unlock real mitigation, probably still not to the scale that's being claimed, but they may still be having a measurable positive climate impact. So it's not to say that all carbon crediting projects are bad and can't play any role, but we need to take a deep look at how carbon credits are actually being used in practice by companies.
The expert advocates for much needed changes in the carbon credit market.
Of course, it's important to say that changing communication around how carbon credits are used doesn't mean that it's okay to give up on delivering high quality credits. Credits need to be of much better environmental quality in the first place, given all the flaws that have emerged in all the literature and investigations. And regardless of how credits are used by companies, they absolutely cannot come at the expense of human rights or equity. And unfortunately, we've seen many cases where carbon crediting projects have caused human rights or land rights abuses, or have entirely lacked transparency regarding financial flows, and whether people on the ground associated with the project actually equitably benefit from the sale of carbon credits. So obviously, regardless of how good the mitigation of a carbon crediting project might be, such abuses should never happen.
As sensible and climate-friendly as the idea of carbon trading may be, the implementation of such projects in Uganda to date has revealed serious shortcomings. The three examples for reforestation projects presented here paint a shocking picture of disadvantaged and mistreated communities. Alleged climate protection comes at the expense of the local population. Far-reaching changes are necessary to ensure that such projects benefit all parties involved in the future. Not only must profits from carbon trading be distributed more fairly, but transparency and communication on the part of project implementers must also improve. International standards such as the free, prior and informed consent require meaningful consultation. Not just informing people, but engaging them in real dialogue, listening to their concerns, and ensuring they understand the project design and its impacts. In the cases of Namwaza and Chikonde, these standards were not fully met. For Namwaza, communities say no consultation took place at all.
Kampani no kujja mu kitundu kino tewaliwo kukkiriziganya wadde n'omulundi n'ogumu. Eyo chance teyaliwo y'okumanya project egenda okujja.
We were not told about this project. We were not consulted, and neither did we consent to giving away our land.
We just saw the army and the police rounding up our area to enforce the eviction. And some people were arrested during these forceful evictions. They told us that the company from Europe wants it.
We
also tried to go to court in Nakawa to challenge the eviction, but we were evicted before even the first hearing of the case. And when the eviction happened, people scattered and no one followed up on the case, and it never proceeded.
While in Chikonda, consultation happened, but was not meaningful, leaving people without a real voice in the process.
They began in 1998.
This is when the Europeans came and asked us if the land we were evicted from belonged to us. They also questioned how long we had stayed on the land. By then, we were around 600 people using that land. Some had houses, while others had gardens full of crops, which we showed to them. But they didn't do or say anything. What followed was forceful eviction in around 2002-2003, where houses and gardens destroyed and red produces being harvested by company workers.
Once done well, these projects could benefit the communities and the environment at large. But how should this be? Julius explains.
Ekisoka yandibadde nga tennaba na kutandika n'esooka eyogerazaganya n'abantu aba ku kitundu oba abaali mu ttaka eryo.
And the project should have sought free, prior and informed consent from the people. Like they should have explained to the people what the project means, who is doing it, and how it is likely to help them. In other words, transparency is very key in this process. This would convince people either to accept it or not, other than just evicting them or even coercing them to accept it.
At least nekwate ekitundu ekimu ekitali mu bantu.
If it had been done that way, people would even welcome it, and they would also serve as outgrowers to support this project. But also, if the company did not evict us or use the land that was not occupied by the people, could remain in our land and serve as outgrowers, and this would benefit the project too.
And as we wrap up today's episode, you should be reminded that African countries are on the journey transiting from fossil fuels to renewable energy, and this requires you too to embrace the efforts and be part of the great transformation. And before we end the program, please, if you want to listen to us, visit our website www.witnessradio.org or visit Google Play Store and download the Witness Radio app. And in case you would like to reach us out, please chat with us on our WhatsApp +256 745 965 765, or through calling us directly on +256 414 697 221, and we will hear from you or on all our social media platforms. Thank you for tuning in to Witness Radio. Stay tuned, stay informed, and stay inspired to be part of the energy revolution. Please do not forget that Eyes on a Just Energy Transition airs on Witness Radio every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 10 a.m. East African Standard Time. Catch us again, same time, same radio station. This program was produced by Tony Katende and Lisa Bainda. I am with Stephen, your host.
That was Eyes on a Just Energy Transition, amplifying community voices and keeping justice at the center of Africa's clean energy shift. Join us again next time and keep your eyes open for change.